There's a whole lot of things I want to tell you about. Adventures, dangerous and queer. Some you could guess, and some I've only hinted at. So please lend me your ear.
Everyone has a relationship with gender. What's your story? Hello and welcome to Gender Stories with your host, Dr. Alex Yantafi.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Gender Stories. I know I always say that I'm excited, but I truly am. And I cannot wait to share this interview with you, Gender Stories listeners. And I cannot wait for you to read the book that this amazing person has written. So today, I am sitting with Hari Ziad, who is a cultural critic, a screenwriter, and the editor-in-chief of Race Better. They are a 2021 Lambda Literary Fellow, and their writing has been featured in BuzzFeed, Out, The Guardian, Face Magazine, and the academic journal Critical Ethnic Study, among other publications. Previously, they were the managing editor of the Black Youth Project and a script consultant on the television series David Makes Men. Hari spends their all-too-rare free time trying to get their friends to give the latest generation of R&B starlets a chance and attempting to entertain their always very unbothered pitbull mix, Keone. So welcome. Thank you so much for coming on to Gender Stories.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Alrighty. Well, I really appreciate you making the time. And like I was saying in the introduction, I really, truly love your book. And so let's start from there. Tell the listeners about this book that's out and why you wrote it at this particular moment in time.
Yes, and thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it. My book, Black Boy Out of Time, is a memoir that just came out at the beginning of March. It documents my experiences as one of 19 children in a Hare Krishna and Muslim family. My mother was Hindu. And what it meant to navigate the carceral structures that were around us that were influencing that experience and healing from that now as an adult through an abolitionist lens. So the book is about abolition as a healing practice. And it just documents how I made it here as the journalist and writer that I am today from Cleveland, East 128th Street to New York.
Thank you. And yes, thank you. Sorry, I should have also named the title of your book. So thank you for catching that and actually giving the title of your book to our listeners. And I'll make sure that, of course, in the episode description, you're going to have links to Hari's website and the book. There's so much that I love about the book that I can hardly pick a starting point. But when I was reading it, what I really loved about the book is that for me it was a book about healing. It's a book about faith. It's about abolition, like you said, about family and the experience of growing up Black and queer in this world where anti-Blackness is so incredibly pervasive and shapes the life of Black children. And it's also a book about trauma and grief and healing and ancestral grief and historical trauma and hope. So that's why it's so hard to even pick a starting point. But maybe let's start from where the book in some way starts with you kind of creating the term misanthropedia for a specific type of experience. Is it okay if we start from there?
Yeah, that's perfect. So you want me to just go into like how that came to be?
Yeah, just how that came to be, like, and why did you feel the need to create a specific term, which I think it's really at the intersection of gendered and racialized experience.
Right.
In a lot of ways. So it seemed like a good place to start, given the focus on gender of this podcast.
So my work has always revolved around Black childhoods, and that's been for a long time. And so I've always had this like frustration with a lack of language around the specific experiences that Black children have and in the specific ways that childhood and Blackness intersect to affect those experiences. But when writing the book, it really came to a head. Like, if this entire book is going to be about that, then there needs to be something that kind of guides and ties it all together. And I was also inspired by the way that Misogy Noir was created by Moya Bailey, a Black feminist scholar, to describe how sexism and anti-Blackness intersect in the lives of Black women, which really did a lot of great things in pushing conversations forward around Black women's experience in the last couple of years. And so I was hopeful that with a term like Miss Afropedia, we could talk about things like the school to prison pipeline, talk about things like the adultification of Black children, and talk about all of these things in a way that kind of brings it all together and ties it also to carceral logics and the carceral system. And so that is what I was hoping to do. And so Miss Afropedia just literally means the oppression that Black children experience specifically. And I found it so necessary when writing this book because, like I was saying, this book is so much about like Black childhood trauma, but in particular, it's about the separation that Black people, well, the separation that I have from like my childhood experiences, which I was able to tie to the carceral state and carceral systems and carceral logics and throughout. And so Miss Afropedia is used in the book to try to combat that separation between us and our childhood selves as adults, which I think is a really important part of the healing process that we need to, as that we all need, but in particular that Black mm-hmm. people need if we're going to ever live in a world where we're a little bit more free.
Absolutely. And again, I was like, oh, I want to go in three different directions at once. I want to have a conversation about healing and this beautiful sentence you have about healing in the book that I want to talk about. But before I do that, I actually want to stay a little bit about with the writing of the book, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're a Black author writing this book. As I was reading it, as like, I'm Italian, I'm an immigrant here, I'm a light-skinned person, and there were things I could connect to, but our experiences are very different in so many different ways. And I was wondering, do you feel like you are really writing for a Black audience? And it's fine if other people get something out of it, because that's how art and writing works, right? But who was the audience in your mind, if that makes sense?
Yeah, no, I'm always writing for Black people. And so it's always really fascinating, and I love having these discussions because I think we are so preoccupied with like reaching wider audiences that we sometimes forget that you can still do that and still be very intentional about your core audience. And so my work has always been able to resonate with other people, and I'm not like actively not trying to talk. I'm on this podcast. I think we're going to have a wonderful yeah. conversation. but I'm always very intentional about writing to Black folks. And I do that in particular because I think there's so much that's lost when you're constantly responding to other gazes, in particular, like the white gaze. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's that Toni Morrison quote that is always going around about how racism is such a distraction to the work that we need to do. And so when I'm writing with Black people in mind, I find I have to do much less of like responding to, you know, people saying you're using the race card or like you're race baiting, which is why I chose the name of race baiter, to kind of preempt that whole conversation. Because I don't think we always have to constantly respond. There are some things that we know, and it's okay to say that we know, and we don't have to constantly explain it. And I also think that other people are much smarter than we give them credit for. And if they want to come along this journey, they'll find a way in. Mm-hmm. And so really grateful that you were able to find your way in and come on this journey with us. But definitely writing to Black folks, and in particular to Black people who are interested in doing this journey themselves as well. This book is about people who might want to heal through that same kind of trauma that I'm healing through. And I hope that it gives them some skills that they can use along that journey, because it's such a process, and it will look different. And so even that is not as specific as it can be, that audience, because even all of the Black people in the world, like, there are so many different audiences within.
Exactly.
even the ones who want to do healing work. So even at a more specific level, I was writing for me and writing for my inner child, and writing for my family. I definitely welcome other people coming along in this journey, but I think it's fine for writers to be that specific with their audience.
Absolutely. I don't know. I loved it. And there was so much that kind of resonated across the differences. And yeah, not every reader is like, yes, it's a broad population. And even like, not everybody's a white American also. Mm-hmm. And there were so many things about family, even just being brought up in like a Catholic Italian family in Italy, not in the States, which is a very different experiences. But there were moments like when you talk about your grandma, like I could feel it in my body, like that connection to my own grandma and that relationship and just that sense of family, even across the cultural differences. Anyway, I found it beautiful and I loved it. Yeah. All of that, dear readers, whatever your race or ethnicity or culture, you should read this book because there is so much good in this book from so many perspectives, from so many point of views. And let's go with the healing. You talked about healing. You talked about in some way this, you wrote this book for yourself, and you have this beautiful line about healing in the book, which is, "This society has conditioned me to believe that healing is just the muting of one's rage." And as somebody who's a healer, who's a therapist, who has a lot of criticisms of the therapeutic framework, it got me in the gut in so many ways. Mm-hmm. You know, but yeah, this society has conditioned me to believe that healing is just the muting of one's rage. I feel like there's like multitudes of essays in one line. I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I really loved it. Do you want to say a little bit about the healing as muting of your rage?
Yeah. And I'm so glad that that line resonated, because I think that's so critical to so much of what I was struggling with is because, and I think that a lot of marginalized people struggle with is that we have very legitimate reasons to be enraged about things. And so when we spend so much of our lives judging that part of us, how could we ever be whole? And so for a long time, I like rejected the whole therapeutic model because I had so many experiences that were like that. And I was like, this just doesn't even make sense to me. But there are other ways to heal that don't require you to, the only legitimate ways I would say that don't require you to cut off a very important part of yourself. Anger, rage, sadness are all just emotions that are part of the human experience. Mm-hmm. And we deserve to be able to feel them. Now, how we show them and express them, we can have conversations about what's healthier ways of doing that. But I think we have to start at like that it's okay, especially when we've gone through what we've gone through as Black people in this world, it's okay to feel that rage. And then we can have a discussion of what that looks like when it's expressed. And so that was like the starting point for me. That was when I was able to go back into therapy, was when I found a therapist that it didn't feel like that with all the time. And that is when I was able to make the most strides in my own healing journey is by acknowledging my rage and honoring it as a part of me and an important part of me, and using that as part of my rage is a central part of a lot of the healing work that I do, and that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm really glad that line resonated with you.
I like wrote it, highlighted. I was like, I have 500 feelings in this moment, just relying on, so, you know, partially some of what you said about kind of how much systems of oppression thrive, right, on the silencing of the anger and rage of whoever is oppressed, and how that's perpetuated through systems that are supposed to be about healing, but they're often about conformity, right? It's therapy, or yes, I have a lot of criticism of those models, and also just how culturally Anglo folks are so dissociated from anger and from themselves and from, and have such fragility around anger and rage, which is always seems to be striking to me.
I read a really interesting tweet. I forgot who tweeted it. It was about how like women have been presented as like the more emotional gender. And I was like, I think that's the tweet was talking about how that's only because we've disconnected anger from the idea of emotion. So like, it's not that we don't have access, like white men are very angry all the time, but it's not even thought about as an emotion often, which I thought was a really interesting, especially when it comes to like men, it's not, it's just the way to be a man in this world, which I thought was a really interesting way to put it.
Exactly. And I think that anger gets conflated with behavior, right? Yeah. It's about an emotion that you're feeling and that you can express. It's about like behavior that's seen as okay or not okay, but also who is that behavior seen as okay for?
Right.
I remember like moving from Italy to the UK, all of a sudden I went from being a quiet introvert to really loud, rude extrovert because I didn't know the cultural rules. I was like, what the hell is happening? And I was really young at the time, you know, and it took me years to really unpack kind of just the xenophobia and the context in which some of the stuff that was happening was happening. And I always say to Anglo folks here who don't understand we don't understand what's happening on in terms of white privilege and the uprising, which is literally happened in May after the murder of Mr. George Floyd, which is literally in my neighborhood where I live. And I'm like, I don't even understand how this whole country has not been burned down already by both Indigenous folks and Black folks. And when I look, when I see Anglo-white folks look at me with a question in their eyes, I'm like, the trauma is so deep, the trauma of dissociation from anger is so deep that they can't even understand. Like, once they start to understand it, I think it's almost too big for them to hold because they have no practice. Am I making sense? I don't know.
I think that makes
practicing
perfect sense.
Out loud,
if,
sorry.
Because if they were to acknowledge it, like, where would that leave them? Like, if, you know, I think that's part of it is that once you start to get to the point where you're at, where it's just like, oh, there's so many different legitimate reasons why all of this could be burned down. But what does that mean for if you're white, like your home and you're the wealth you inherited and the land that you're on? And like, you, if you're not ready to give that up, then you can just dismiss all of that and say this is completely invalid. Because we're not ready. We're not having conversations about what that would look like in terms of wealth redistribution and redistributing the land and like, which is where we need to get eventually. And so, yeah, it's really, I see that happening in real time because I don't think they're unable to understand it. I think that it's just to acknowledge it would put them in a very bad position.
You're right. Thank you for that reframe. I think it's so terrifying for them to acknowledge it. I mean, which I get it. It's not like, I mean, literally, I'm blocks from the third precinct. So like our house, we were scared that our house would burn down. Yeah. And I also got it. I was like, of course, like this neighborhood, it makes sense. And we're right now.
Like Black people are afraid too. And that's the why is that they've done such a good job of letting us internalize all of that. And so that we start to police our, which is what the book is about. Like we start doing that policing of ourselves so that, I mean, they're doing it too. But it works so well because even when they're not actual police officers in our neighborhoods, in our homes, we've internalized so much of that policing because we've also internalized that fear. What would the world look like for us with if all of this was redistributed. Like, that's scary if we haven't started talking about and imagining how a different world could look like, which is why abolition is such an imaginative process, because you have to be able to get to that point where you can start talking about things that would change the entire world, and really think about how that could be good for us. And you have to give yourself space to imagine that first. And we've been living our lives so long with everything that is erected just to limit our imagination. So it takes a while to get to that place. But I hope the book helps people to start imagining bigger.
Absolutely. And I love that imagination piece, which I think it's, and that, you know, yes, that's where my brain was going on too, as like that policing piece, right? How that policing is internalized, and it's impossible to escape even within family, which is something that you talk a lot about in the book too. And I know that when I remember a training I did a couple of years ago, and for a therapist, and this Black therapist was also a peer and came up to me and talked about her really starting to realize how much she had policed gender for, and the intersection of gender and race, because it's so the thought, quite understandably, of any Black boy deviating from masculinity and how that can be punished culturally and socially and by the police and in every way. It's terrifying. And so that piece about how the policing is internal, but it's also intergenerational, and it's within the family, and especially when there is that intersection of gender and race and queerness used as a bigger umbrella to encompass gender as well as sexuality. And that's a lot of what's in the book too, right? And it's a tender, you talk about it very tenderly in a lot of ways, and very direct, but very just full of healing intention. That's the best. I love your writing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I love that phrase, full of healing intention. That's yeah, that's exactly what I was aiming for, is like, there are a lot of conflicts that are documented in the book, and there are a lot of conflicts that I experience, and a lot of them are with people I love, and like my mother. And I think the difference between a punitive culture and the world we could have if abolition were to be successful is that we could approach conflict with full of healing intention. And I think you still address it, like you're saying, you're still very direct about it, but it feels a lot different, and it's going to have a different result. My hope is that everything that I write and everything that I do has that same healing intention. But it's a journey, especially when you've lived in a world where it's so easy to just punish people and punish things. And also back to our earlier point about like anger, where we've been convinced in a lot of cases that healing can't involve rage. And what do we do with that when it can? And so we have to unlearn that. And then we can get the full scope of what a healing intent could look like. Because I don't think I'm there yet. I think I'm still figuring out like what healing could look like when I'm angry. Like if I was to see Donald Trump tomorrow, like in front of me, like what could I approach that situation with healing intent? Like I'm still figuring that out. But I think the intent is the part, right? Is like, and that's something that you have to cultivate and bring into your life and practice. And that's what I was trying to do in the book.
I think it comes across beautifully. And I'm glad that we're back to anger in some ways, because anger is very mobilizing. But who gets to be angry? It's not a given, right, in a lot of ways. And so there are a lot of there are lots of moments of conflict. Like you said, there are lots of moments in which there could be anger in a lot of different directions, right? Being coming up Black and queer, and I know you use they, them pronouns, but I don't know if you identify as non-binary. Would you identify as non-binary?
Yes. For simplification, yes. When I talk about gender and Blackness and the intersection there, I still feel like non-binary isn't as comprehensive as it can be for me. But I think just for ease of conversation,
that makes I do want to go back to that, and especially chapter 11 when that's called like my gender is Black, and I definitely want to go there next. But now, of course, I lost both, right? But it's all good. But I was thinking, yes, there is a lot to be angry about in some ways coming up in a world where there's a lot of anti-Blackness, coming up in a world where there's a lot of rigidity around gender, let's say, and being more gender expansive that those rigid gender category would allow for coming up queer. And the anger could go in a lot of different directions, right? Because there's conflict with family, there's conflict with systems. What moved you from anger to abolition? Because that's not where everybody goes, right? Ooh. You know, anger could go towards carceral logic, as mm-hmm. you call it, and punishment and pushback and conflict. Not generative conflict, but really like...
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
Making sense?
No,
I'm
yes.
just curious, how did you make that leap?
I think the short answer is I'm still figuring that out. I think there's a lot of times where I do go to that punitive carceral place.
Punitive, that's the word that I was looking for.
and it's so ingrained that it's something I'll probably be wrestling with for a long time. But I think how abolition became like a part of my intentions is through watching my grandmother and seeing how that. So my grandmother, because you read the book, but for the listeners, my grandmother, she struggled with bipolar disorder, and for most of our lives was untreated, and that resulted in a lot of like terrible mental health crises where police were called, and just seeing how detrimental that was to her overall healing, even though like and so many times that was like the only thing that my mother thought that was she could do, and watching my mother try out of an understanding of this as not being like sustainable or not ultimately being healthy, try so many different things, and seeing how like that was such a expression of her care and her love, and seeing how in the moments where she was able to find an alternative, like the difference in how my grandmother's life was affected, and in turn all of our lives, that kind of like set the seed of like, oh, like there has to be something different. And like, if my mother's tried this hard, and like, yes, maybe she didn't always succeed in finding a solution, but she was trying for a reason, and I can continue doing that work. And so that was like the seed of it. I wasn't really thinking of it in terms mm-hmm. of abolition back then, but especially as I got older and developed a different relationship with my grandmother when she was in a little healthier place, and seeing that like I had so much of the anger that I was legitimate because there were a lot of horrible things that I experienced as a child that I shouldn't have experienced, but I directed so much of it at her and without ever acknowledging like her own mental health struggles, without acknowledging everything else that was going on. That to me illuminated that there could be another way, because the anger was still there. So even while I was mm-hmm. developing this new relationship with her, there was still the anger there, but it could be used in a different way. And so much of my journey toward abolition has been informed by that, and about trying to reestablish a relationship with my grandmother, specifically after she passed away, doing altar work, and being able to have that kind of relationship with her now that like she's not I can engage with her without even the struggles that she was living through, even when she was healthier, like towards the end of her life. And being able to imagine what that engagement would look like through altar work allows me to imagine how I can engage with other people who might still be here differently. And allows me to engage with my mother, like, oh, what if she wasn't dealing with all of these things that she was dealing with when she and I had this tension around my queerness and sexuality, which doesn't mean that it doesn't exist and doesn't mean I'm not angry about it. But I can engage her knowing that there is a possible world where that is not the case, because there's a possible world where she wasn't taught all of these things too. And so my anger gets directed to the world and the system that shaped her. Although, I mean, some of it is still directed to her, and I think that's fine. But I think ultimately it recognizes what's at the root of it. And in order to do that, you have to, like we were talking about earlier, you have to be able to acknowledge first that the anger is legitimate before you can direct it to a place that's legitimate. And so it took a lot of me understanding and being able to finding my new therapist who was able to legitimize that anger that I was feeling in order to me to come to where I am now. But I think I'm still on that journey.
And it's such a long journey. I know for myself and for a lot of my clients too, that journey of reconciling, kind of understanding the broader context in which things that were not okay happen sometimes. Mm-hmm. Way too many of us with family members, and understanding how, you know, in your specific context, how much of that is born out of anti-blackness and settler colonialism and racism, right? That all of this bigger and misogyny and the misanthropedia and all of those big contexts. And yet it's also in the relationship, right? Mm. In the personal relationship. And I love what you said about how much healing that can be in engaging with ancestors. Mm-hmm. You know, grandma, what I would call an ancestor, and you can engage for that altar work. In my experience, that's different too. Doing ancestor work rather than with like leaving family members, where there can be a different kind of tension, at least in my experience.
Yeah. It opens up so much. Like, I think that was what made it easier for me to do inner child work too. I had started doing altar work, and growing up Hindu, like I was kind of familiar with the concept mm-hmm. of it already. But the idea that you can have a different relationship, or you can continue a relationship, mm-hmm. even though like you're told that you don't have a connection to that person anymore. And I think for like, it's very useful to be told that as for the society to continue, like they're intentionally trying to strip us from as Black people from our histories. And so getting a lot of that power back through ancestor work mm-hmm. Is kind of parallels the healing that you do with inner child work and the child that you're told that you don't necessarily have a connection with anymore, or you feel that you don't have a connection with anymore. And once that's possible, you're like, oh, maybe it's possible to create a whole entire new world too.
Absolutely. I mean, I think so, but you know, I'm very much of like a optimistic Pisces. I'm like, a new world is possible. It's just going to take a lot of work. And it's not all like, it doesn't look harmonious. I think that the path, you know, towards kind of a abolitionist kind of vision does include really acknowledging the anger and the hurt, and we can't bypass it. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes even white folks who want to engage with abolition kind of want to bypass the rage. And I was like, you can't bypass the rage yeah. there, because there needs to be a repair. Because if an abolitionist vision still includes harm happening and repair being possible. I don't know, in my understanding and my...
No, I completely agree. I was at an abolitionist conference and one of the white panelists and I were getting into a debate because they said that the concept of enemies is not abolitionist. And I was like,
whoa.
I understand why that's useful for you as a white person. But that's not the case. And we've been doing abolition. Indigenous communities have been doing abolition, knowing that they've had enemies that they've also had to fight against. And so it's really interesting. But I think, like we were saying earlier, it comes from a place of self-preservation. Like, if you're going to engage in this abolitionist work, like,
yes,
it would mean giving up so much as a white person. And mm-hmm. if the rage isn't there, then maybe you don't have to face that rage, because some of it might be legitimately trained on you. And
right,
we have to learn how to, and that's what's so beautiful about this healing work, is I think it also teaches us how to receive rage and how to receive hurt, that in be accountable for harms in different ways, because we're not just expected to push it away or say that it's just harmful or evil or bad. And we have to really do the work to sit with something and someone who we might have harmed and repair that, which is the only way that I've ever experienced harm being repaired in my families, with myself, in my communities. And I think if we're going to ever have a world that ever moves past this white supremacist framework, that's what's going to have to happen with white folks as well.
Oh, absolutely. And anger is such a gift, because it's like, if somebody's angry with me and there's enough relationship that they can tell me, what a gift. Whereas, you know, what us younger white folks doing is like trying to bypass anger or pretend there is no anger. Reminds me of like a conflict I had with a friend who was like, I feel like when you're angry, you direct your anger at me. I was like, well, if I'm mad at you, would you want me to be mad at? Like, I'm mad at you with your behavior, and I'm telling you because I want to repair. And I was also like, it's not like you're not mad. It's just that your anger is cold and dissociative, and you just cut me off and don't talk to me. That doesn't feel great. That's still anger. And you could see the light bulb going off. Like, I was like, it's not that white people don't do anger. I think in my experience, Anglo-white folks do anger in this like really dissociative, cold way where they like cut you up and you don't even know what happened sometimes. And you're like, what happened?
Yeah.
Especially West, I have to say. I was like, I didn't even know we were in conflict, let alone you were angry with me. And how can there be relationship and repair, like, if we're not capable of giving and receiving anger with one another?
Right.
Because that's a human emotion that's going to happen. And it's part, I'm all of that you said. I'm just kind of connecting because that's how my brain works. I hope that's okay. I feel like I want to talk more about anger and about abolition, but I also know that my podcast is about gender. And you have this beautiful chapter whose title is My Gender is Black. And I want you to talk about that. So I feel like I'm like pulling myself back from the abolitionist track that I would want to talk about more. Maybe we'll go back to it for this.
Yeah, I think it's connected for sure. Because I think the ways that we construct gender is rooted in these very putative ideas that are binary and that don't give room for people to be their whole selves, in the same way that we could talk about anger. Like, I think they're all very much connected. And in particular, the experience of Black people who and they're trying to make sense of gender in this country in particular, which is a country that we were brought here, most of us, as ungendered subjects, like people who were slaves. And like, we, our gender only meant as much as it could create more slaves. And so that chapter is about like what it means to try and find gender in a society where gender was not designed for you. And what does it mean to what does it mean to reject that concept entirely? And not because I don't think that we can be gendered. And I just think that the ways that we think about gender under this society has never given room for Black people. And so in that regard, I would say like all Black people are agender in that sense. But I think that there's other ways to find gender, other ways that we've done gender, that might be more useful in figuring out our place in whatever world comes after this one. But yeah, I think it's totally tied to the concept of like what you're allowed to be and what is acceptable to perform. I think the ways that even rage and like we were talking about earlier, that rage and anger are even conceived and tied to gender. It shows up differently, like when a woman is enraged and she's hysterical. And when a non-binary person is enraged, they don't exist because there's aren't no non-binary people.
We're a figment of people's imagination.
And when cis men are enraged, it's just the way that, like, it's the behavior, like you were talking about. And so I think all of that is going to feel restrictive to Black people in particular, because it doesn't give, I think it's going to feel restrictive to anyone because it doesn't give anyone room to be their whole selves. But I think even more so for people who, those concepts have only ever contributed to us being commodities and us being sold and exploited, that it'll take a new idea. Or it's not even new. I think it's a lot of this is, these are ideas that have been around for a long time, but it'll take a different idea of gender than the ones that we're taught here in this society.
Yeah, and you make so many, yes, so many good points. It's like, you know, cause in exactly that, it's like, this kind of, settler colonial rigid idea of the gender binary is sold, I think, and packaged in kind of Western dominant culture as if this is the, in air quotes, natural way of things and the way things are and the way it's always been. And it's actually not. It's a product of settler colonialism and white supremacy and the transatlantic slave trade and all of those kind of things together. And one of, yeah, how did you find your way to your own current gender? And I say current because I also believe that our gender landscape evolves as I don't know. I just turned 50 and the way I relate to my gender now at 50, it's really different than when I was 30 or 20. And
yeah,
just different now. That's the best way. I'm still processing it in some way. But so how did you find your way to your current gender through all of that historical trauma and wisdom and connection and lack of connection and all of that?
Yeah, I think where I am in my gender journey is always related to like my journey towards my healing with my inner child also. Because for me, I think where I started having a shift is like, there was a time, at least, and maybe I've made this all up in my head, and that's also possible, but there was a time where I wasn't thinking about gender in that way. And, or at least it wasn't conscious to me in that way. And like, gender wasn't the thing that limited me from like who I could express love to, how I could dress and just be in the world. And so what were the things that I, what did I gravitate toward during that time? Finding, rediscovering that through the inner child work is always going to be what's gearing me on my gender journey. And that's just like rediscovering different things I love, rediscovering how I liked to wear my clothes at certain, like, and I don't think it's always like a conscious thing, but I'm much more aware of when something does come up, like, oh, I like that because like that reminds me of this experience when I was a child, and like that just that was what felt good then. And so, I think I'm always just on this journey of trying to get back to a time that, and maybe like I said, that time didn't really fully exist in the, in this lifetime, but maybe. I think I'll go wherever it takes me. Maybe it'll take me before this lifetime. Maybe it'll take me to my grandmother, and it already has done that with the altar work. And maybe it'll take me beyond that with whatever other research I do in my family tree. But it's always about like trying to rediscover who I was before I learned to hate my gendered body. And so, yeah, that's where I am now.
I got tearful when you said that, because as you were describing that, I had this feeling of your gender journey, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I felt like your gender journey is so guided by expansiveness and expansion. How can you expand into possibility for that inner child that maybe never had that space to really fully expand into whatever gender identity and expression was joyful and pleasurable and pleasant? And when I think how much our ideas of gender lead us to constriction, you know, describing, I've got a book on the gender and trauma, and I talk about how it feels like we're collectively all holding our breath around gender because of all this intersection of like settler colonialism and all those other things that we've already named, that there's so much policing around gender that we're all kind of holding our breath and having this constriction, and part of the liberatory work is to expand. Mm-hmm. And liberatory work has to be intersectional, because we cannot talk about gender and not talk about race and not talk about settler colonialism and all those things. And it was, I don't know, it was just so moving to hear you talk about the work being, I don't know, it felt really guided by that feeling of freedom and expansion. I don't know if that's how it feels.
No, I think that rings true. And it, at the very least, that's what I want it to always. I wanted my gender to not be something that restricts me in a world that I've already been so restricted. I want, with every new discovery about my gender, to feel a little more free. So that's where I head. Whatever takes me towards that feeling is where my next stop is on the gender journey.
Beautiful. What I love also is in your book, you don't shy away from naming that, regardless of your own experience of oppression around gender or policing or limitation, how you've also participated in harm sometimes, because how could we not live in a system that is so rigid when it comes to gender and so policing that we haven't participated in that harm in some way of perpetuating it, right? And again, I think it comes back to this idea of abolition is also being really accountable for our participations in systems.
Yeah.
And talk about that in the book, even in your family relationships. Yes. And
yeah.
Anything about that?
It's really fascinating. What always fascinates me about like when people are critical of abolition, it's one, they're always bringing up like, what do we do when rapists and murderers? And but it always goes to, there's a reason they bring up rapists and murderers, because they don't want to talk about the harms that they've participated in. But when you see abolitionists in action, you'll find for the most part that we're engaging in accountability practices with all of these harms already. And so we're showing what you do. We're trying to demonstrate. I mean, a lot of times we fail and we make mistakes, but part of the process of being an abolitionist is to show what you do when harm is part. And you have to be willing to show when you do, when you're the person who has harmed other people, because we all do that. Hopefully we don't do it to the extent where they're like, they've been oppressed by us, but we've all harmed other people. And so, I mean, it's really important to situate that in our own lives and in our own communities. And I don't think it's worth just talking about it to pat yourself on the back and like, oh, I'm accountable, blah, blah, blah. But I think it is important to show what working through that process looks like, what are the challenges, what you still might be struggling with, because I still do struggle with that. And so that's what I wanted to show in the book.
And I think you did. I think you did it so beautifully, you know, and kind of looking at my notes and going, oh, there are so many quotes that I could pull up. But I also want to be respectful of your time, although I will pull up one quote, actually, which kind of, I think to me, it does connect. You talk about, this quote talks, says, the most depressing thing about being queer in this world is the fact that isn't just the possibility of your sexuality that you're taught to be afraid of. A world where you can hold the person you love without guilt terrifies you too. I'd never held another boy in my arms. I'd never been held that way with my consent either. And I've been taught that I was never supposed to feel that much joy. So I could only beat myself up when I did, which is, for me, what I love about that quote is that complexity, right? Again, of like, it's not just being accountable for harm we can do to others, but somehow that even joy needs to stay a little bit in this constricted place. This possibility of expansion is scary and terrifying.
A lot of the harm that we do is to ourselves. That's what this book is about. Is about how so much, like, yes, I've harmed other people. A lot of that just for their own privacy. Like, I wouldn't want to necessarily bring that up, but so much more of that, I mean, so much more consistently, like those same ideas, like we don't avoid pointing them into ourselves. Like, we use the same tools that we've used to move throughout the world against ourselves. Mm-hmm. And what does it look like to be accountable for it to yourself too? Like, that's just as central to this whole process of abolition. Is working through your own inner conflicts and figuring out when you've harmed yourself and how to be accountable to yourself and redress for the harms that you've committed against yourself also. And that's the hard part. And that's why having a good therapist is really great, because they can help you with that, hopefully. That's the hard part. And it's also, like, I think too often it's removed from the other work that we have to do as abolitionists, but it's so central to all of it. Because if we can't model that with ourselves, how are we going to model that with anyone else?
Exactly. Yes. I could keep talking about this for hours, but like I said, I want to be respectful of your time. And dear listeners, if the idea of abolition is new to you, there are also two other episodes of Gender Stories where I talked with Deanna Ayers, and actually one is just me and Deanna, and the other one is me and McJohn Barker and Deanna, and we talk about abolition. So if this is the first time you've heard about abolition, you might want to check this out. And of course, then it leads you to other resources, but just to kind of bookmark it for folks if they want to delve deeper into this, and also read Harry's book, because it's so good. I just can't even find better words than "it's so good" and everybody should read it. But like I said, I want to be respectful of your time, Marie. And so is there anything that I haven't asked you about or haven't brought up that you were hoping to talk about or that you would really like to share with the listeners?
No, I think that was pretty, I mean, I could also talk with you. Those were great questions. I could talk for longer, but I think that felt comprehensive to me also. Felt like a great conversation. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts about your process and also just your very personal journey with our listeners. And dear listeners, as ever, thank you for being here with us, and I'll see you next time.